Welcome to Cattle HQ, a podcast from industry experts and progressive producers discussing cutting-edge info about the cow-calf sector to keep cattlemen and women in the know and positively affect their bottom line.
Welcome to Cattle HQ, brought to you by South Dakota State University Extension. I am Madison Kavarna, a beef nutrition field specialist based out of Watertown, and joining me on this episode is Kaylee Wheeler. Kaylee is a range field specialist with SDSU Extension and has a deep passion for South Dakota rangeland and grazing livestock systems. She is based out of our Peer Regional Center. I am also pleased to share that we are joined by Ray Powers from the Xerces Society. Ray has a deep passion for working with landowners to create pollinator habitats and focuses on the function and diversity of mixed grass prairies. Ray covers both Nebraska and South Dakota for the Xerces Society. Both Kaylee and Ray are joining me today to discuss some information about the importance of native plants and results from native plant research they have both played roles in. This kind of plays off of our episode 2 weeks ago, or however long ago that was. This plays off of that episode here. And we're kind of diving into maybe some other work that other companies have done, other organizations have done in this space. And Kaylee was on that episode previously to discuss the SDSU Native Forb Research Project. Ray, would you want to shed some light on some previous work that the Xerces Society has helped with or conducted and give a brief introduction for our listeners?
Yeah, great. Thanks for having us, Madison. It's so nice to be here. So starting in about 2019 or 2020, the Xerces Society staff in the Great Plains, and we're all in partner positions with NRCS, or the Natural Resources Conservation Services, we've been working on sort of a very broad guidelines for rangeland management for pollinators. So sort of the things you want to think about on rangeland that are inclusive of pollinator health. And one thing that's pretty common in the Great Plains rangelands, which is really disappointing for those of us who love wildlife and plants, is sort of broadcast aerial sprays of broadleaf herbicides. And so to counter some of those sprays, we really thought, let's include some data on, you know, the forage value of wildflowers, so we can communicate to our ranchers that, you know, these plants have value for your livestock. And so we went looking for that data, and there was some scattered, very small data sets we could find. And of course, you'd see anecdotally things included in, you know, range documents or plant guides that said, you know, highly palatable or high protein, but there really wasn't kind of a full picture of what these plants were providing. And it certainly wasn't inclusive of many of the plants that we see quite abundantly on rangelands, wildflowers in particular. So with funding from NRCS, and specifically North Dakota NRCS, and in partnership with North Dakota State University in 2021, we started collecting samples from across the northern and central Great Plains of plants. And this was, it took a lot of lead time, honestly. We spent a lot of time thinking about which wildflowers to include and conversing with experts. And we looked at national range inventory data, NRI data, to kind of make sure that what we were thinking were common and abundant rangeland wildflowers were in fact found, you know, pretty abundantly on these landscapes. And we worked with range experts to kind of, at least anecdotally, hear about the palatability of these plants. You know, is this something you think cattle have been eating, or you've seen them eating, or you suspect they're eating? And kind of the final piece of selecting our plant list was, you know, are they useful for pollinators? So we wanted, you know, wildflowers primarily, but a lot of the plants that we chose are, you know, pretty big hitters when it comes to supporting a wide array of pollinators and other insects. And so the first year was sort of a trial year, and we had no concept of north to south, sort of that would be Nebraska to North Dakota, or east to west within those states, if this data would vary at all. So we just sort of scattershot across a few states and tried to systematically get, you know, sort of central east west in each of the Dakotas and Nebraska. And kind of early 2022, when those samples were rolling back in and we were starting to look at some actual data, it seemed that at least when it came to forage quality, so kind of the crude protein and the total digestible nutrients, that north to south didn't look like it had much impact, and the east to west also wasn't huge. So 2022 and 2023, we just kind of went for it, and we got a much broader array of plants and samples, and we were also kind of looking across the life cycle of these plants. So, early when they're vegetative, pre-flowering, flowering, and then post-flowering. So we ended up with about around 1,000 samples of about 75 species. And we did broaden the geography a little bit too. So we were collecting samples from about 10 states, all kind of surrounding those Nebraska and Dakotas area. So it's a complex data set, and it's not always systematic. In North Dakota, we had kind of crews and staff going out. So we've got a pretty solid data set from three sites across the state with the same plants in different growth stages. In other states, a lot of it was opportunistic, and we relied a lot on NRCS field office staff and other colleagues and partners to collect plants when they were doing other work. So, some samples or some species we might have 1 to 2 samples, and other species we might have, 43 samples. So, yeah, it's an interesting data set, and definitely there's a lot to build on, but it's been really fun to see sort of this preliminary work.
I would say the same thing to bounce off of you, Ray, that a lot of this data that's been coming out the last couple of years, not only through the Xerces societies, but also just a bunch of partners, and now SDSU Extension with their new project going on, there's so much information coming out that I think is bringing light to a lot of things that maybe we didn't necessarily understand completely, which for me has been super intriguing to get into. And as you mentioned, I mean, the amount of data you're collecting is immense. There's a lot of numbers coming back. There's a lot of samples. There's a lot of communication back and forth. And that I have no doubt that that's been pretty complex to handle. And I'm sure it can get to be pretty impressive once you start to look at it all together. But since we're kind of on that trend of talking about the data and the complexity of it, to bring it down pretty simply, and I'll ask Gray first and then Kaylee. I also want to see your opinion on what you've seen in the SDSU project, but what has been the coolest part of all of this data that you've collected? Are you surprised by a certain plant? Has it been that, for me, it was interesting to hear that there's really no directional difference, majorly there that you kind of mentioned a few minutes ago. That was cool for me, but was there anything kind of intriguing that you saw in your data as it was starting to come back, Gray?
Yeah, I mean, I think overwhelmingly, just how positive our results have been. So I think 73% of the species we looked at were meeting the minimum requirement for a lactating cow when it came to crude protein. And then when we started to look at the total digestible nutrients, that jumped up to about 93% of those plant species. So not only are these plants high in protein, but they're not producing these indigestible fibers that sort of prevent that protein from being usable by livestock. So I think the first, really exciting thing was just how many of these species are, actually really good forage. The second piece of this has been we also analyzed about 14 macro and micro minerals. And that has been really interesting. I've learned a lot about cattle and nutrition and livestock, and that's just been very complex. But of some of those few really primary minerals that we're thinking about with livestock, our native wildflowers are often performing above minimum requirements, and they are nearly always providing more of those macro and micro minerals than our native grass forage is at the same time. So as we're further understanding those minerals, I think, we're starting to see a fuller picture of what these plants are providing. And when I started talking with range experts about this work and do cattle eat wildflowers, a lot of times I'd get the sort of answer like, well, they probably take a couple of bites, probably for minerals. So I think yes, that's definitely true, but it's also providing this really high forage quality. And a couple of species that were maybe not super shocking to me because of my background, but I think are for many other rangeland practitioners were milkweeds. So in my experience in the sort of south central Nebraska, on some rangelands there, I knew that was a pretty highly desirable livestock feed option, was our common milkweed. And there has since been some research actually on those sites from the University of Nebraska in from Omaha that they're actually preferentially going to common milkweed, and they will even go into pretty dense vegetation to get to that milkweed. And we saw that common and showy milkweed had really high protein levels that kind of sustained throughout the growing season. So it was like, oh yeah, that's starting to make a little bit more sense. But I think, a lot of times we get on this like milkweed is poisonous, it's toxic. And when it comes to the species in the central and northern Great Plains, out on growing range, those species are not high in cardenolides, which is the toxic component. None of our species are super toxic here in the northern and central Great Plains. So it's just nice to sort of validate that, milkweeds are good, especially coming from, pollinator and monarch standpoint. Those are plants we really need.
Yeah, I wanted to add on to what Ray just said about the milkweeds. As far as the coolest part of the data, it's not really data specific, but one of the coolest part of the pro parts of the project is hearing from producers about their experiences with certain plants. So like Ray said, a lot of us were trained to kind of know certain plants as either palatable or unpalatable for livestock forage. And milkweed is one of those things that, it has that sticky substance, and, some people think that it's toxic. And you wouldn't think that cattle necessarily would want to graze it, but some of the producers I've worked with swear that their cattle will, go out of the way to eat those milkweeds. So it's really, really cool that now we have the data that's showing in most cases it's, almost 20% crude protein and 75% TDN. So to put that into perspective, lactating cow requirements is going to be about 10 to 12% crude protein and 60% TDN. And lactating small ruminants, so sheep and goats, their requirements are going to be about 15 to 16% crude protein and 66% TDN. So when Ray is sitting here saying that, over 75% of the plants that they've collected have met or exceeded the crude protein requirements of lactating livestock, and I think you said almost 90% of the plants you collected are exceeding the TDN or the energy requirements. So that is just fascinating to me, that we have this, very broad buffet, if you will, for our lactating livestock to be able to, pick and choose what they eat out on the range to be able to meet their requirements. I just think it's so cool.
And truly, it is impressive that these plants are meeting those minimum requirements for those lactating animals, as our lactating animals simply require more of everything. They require more energy, more protein, all those things, because now they're not only producing for themselves, but they're also producing this nutrient-rich substance for these young that are nursing from them, and that takes a lot of energy. That act of lactation requires a lot of input from the animal, and the fact that these plants that historically maybe we look out on our rangelands and say, that's a weed, I need to, broadcast spray, or I need to go out there and get rid of it for my cattle to be healthier or my sheep to have better condition, those type of things. I think it's just something that we really need to keep at the forefront of our minds that, Mother Nature made these plants for a reason, and maybe we need to look at our management strategy and start to maybe readjust that. I know last time I talked with Kaylee about maybe what some species were on her list. And Ray, I was curious If you had mentioned you guys had kind of gone the wildflower route, but did you work with Kaylee and her team, that kind of what's the word I'm looking for here? The internal team, the major team, the decision makers, on making that specie list that we were looking at on this SDSU version?
We did, and it was really nice to be a part of that conversation, and we were able to kind of give them an idea of like, okay, we've gotten 27 samples of this species in South Dakota, so like maybe you don't need to go after that one so extensively. So they were able to, get a full picture of, these are the species that we've collected more broadly. This is what we have from South Dakota. What would you guys like to fill in from that data set? And this work with the South Dakota, excuse me, Grassland Coalition and SDSU. Is exactly the outcome we wanted from this preliminary data set. We just really wanted other people to take this over and take ownership of it, because it's certainly too big and too broad of a project for Xerces and NRCS to take on by ourselves. So it's just been really delightful to watch it grow and happen in real time. And I'm so excited to see the data coming from this year out of South Dakota. It's just going to be an incredible depth of data.
Yeah, and I will add to that that that's another awesome part of this project is just the level of collaboration that we have between our organizations. So, Xerces really kind of put themselves out on the line by going after these plants first and kind of just, as Ray said, kind of a shotgun sampling approach to kind of just see what they could find. And then now other states, North Dakota State and South Dakota State, have kind of jumped on the bandwagon to help support this work because we've realized how incredible the results are going to be. And yeah, exactly as Ray said, what we try to do with South Dakota is fill in the gaps of what Xerces already had. So I believe Xerces had about 75 samples or 75 species that they had about 1,000-ish samples during their collection. So we focused in on 30 species in South Dakota, and we'll have about 1,000 samples just across the state of South Dakota from this year. So, as with all science, the more data, the more samples that you can get, the more that you can really be confident in those results, especially when it comes to feed values and minerals and things like that. So.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, our initial data set too only prompted more questions about, that could feed on some of this additional sampling. But, some of the ongoing questions that we're thinking about are sampling just different plant parts, to see, because we know cattle are selectively choosing on some plants just certain parts of the plant, like the flowering stalk or the flower top. So yeah, as soon as you get a little bit of data, all you want is more and more, and you just have more and more questions.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to, I know probably several universities, SDSU in particular, is wanting to kind of dive into that side of behavioral grazing on the research side. So exactly what Ray just said, we know that cattle and sheep and goats, they all kind of selectively graze differently. And, small ruminants in particular, they can get really selective on the plant parts. So, they can actually graze to select for a higher quality diet by being able to, just pick the leaves off of the shrubs and things like that. So I think there's some real value in potentially looking at different plant parts as well.
Yeah, and I think the next big push also that I think this data has sort of re-energized is, even broader than plant parts is actually just diet selection in general and how our actions and management impact, what plants cattle are eating and livestock. So I'm excited to hopefully be a part of some research looking at some of that palatability, which yes, the more I learn, the more complex it seems to be.
I am a firm believer, and I said this last time with Kaylee too, that if I said it in the realm of cattle, but really any livestock species, that they will be as picky as we let them. And if we give them the tools and just the variety, they will pick a better diet than I could ever dream of making on a paper and giving to a producer to utilize. And I think that's the coolest thing, is that our livestock can go out there and do an amazing job. And how can we support them in that as well? And right, you brought up a good point of how this information can be used by not only our producers, but our landowners or land managers and others. You know, these results are going to affect them and their choices greatly. But how can those people that come across this episode utilize the things we've kind of talked about, or if they find our results published somewhere, in their management style or their daily life? What are you hoping that they can kind of get out of these results and use them for decision making? And I'll start with Ray first, and then Kaylee, I'll let you come in and see if you have anything to add or things like that.
Yeah, I think our goal from the outset and first and foremost, I would say, I hope this decreases the amount of aerial broadcast broadleaf herbicides that we see on rangelands, just knowing that these plants have value. So that's sort of the low bar or the high bar, I'm not sure. And then I think, and Kaylee's heard me speak about this data set before and use this analogy, but like we have all been to a pretty simple or plain salad bar, right? We've been to a salad bar with iceberg lettuce and cheese and ranch and olives and some pasta salads, and you got to make a meal out of that. But we've also probably all been to really awesome salad bars where the choices are nearly endless. And I like to think about, which salad bar would I rather make a meal out of? And it's the fancy salad bar that's providing, anything I dream up. And that's really what I want ranchers to think about their rangelands. You want to have diverse rangelands so that your livestock can make those choices, just like you were saying, right? So providing a diverse array of native plants, both grasses and wildflowers, allows our livestock to fulfill their nutritional needs and their mineral needs more fully than a depauperate landscape where we only have grasses and a few species of wildflowers. So I think, trying to give any management recommendations that are specific is, so hard. It's just so specific and based on your landscape and your goals. But just having that diversity on the ground is the ultimate goal, I think.
Yeah, I'll add on to that. I think Ray's analogy of the salad bar is just awesome. And I think that is the, long-term goal of the work like this and understanding the behavior of grazing. I want to see cows, I want to see producers let cows be cows. Like, if there's anything we can do to reduce our, supplementation inputs and, not having to feed them as much, that, I mean, that's the number one cost on a cow-calf operation is feed. So if we can let a cow be a cow, do the work to meet her own nutritional needs, make her own salad, if you will, by being able to select whatever plants they can, I just think the potential implications of that is huge, especially financially. So yeah, just I think understanding, every insect, every plant, and every animal has a role to play in the system. And I think, whether you're a producer out on the landscape or not, it's really important that we start paying attention to those things. Just figuring out how to take care of our land and, how to restore land and, what plants can I plant in my garden that's going to help the pollinators and, things like that. But I also think there's potential huge implications with targeted grazing and multi-species grazing. Cattle and sheep and goats, they have some dietary overlap. But general rule of thumb is that if you have a good diverse landscape, you can run one sheep behind one cow and not increase the amount of land that you need. But the key there is that you have to have the diversity there so that the animals can select what they need for their diet. So also targeted grazing to reduce potential undesirables on the landscape and just things like that. I think there's a lot of potential grazing implications of this research.
Haley, you brought up a good point of, what can I plant in my garden to help pollinators? And I think that's a point that I want to emphasize that, we end up talking a lot about producers, and I find myself guilty of this, of producers and people who have livestock and those who are directly involved. But this type of information can be utilized not only by those people, but also at home in your backyard when you're thinking about what you want to landscape with, what you're going to plant in your garden, if you're going to plant just, your producing plants, those fruits and vegetables, or if you're going to put some of those native flowers to bring in those pollinators to help you out in that aspect. Or are you someone who rents out your land and is just kind of that non-operating landowner? Are you one of those people that can maybe help those that are managing your land for you kind of improve your investment of what you're doing there? And I think that's a good point to always bring in is that this information that both of you are working so hard on and bringing a lot of information to the table isn't just for those with those livestock directly under their care. And we're getting close to the end of our episode here, so I just wanted to open the floor to either of you. If you had any closing comments for our listeners.
Yeah, I think, kind of as we turn the conversation to pollinators, a lot of times when I'm talking about this work, I really do talk about a lot about livestock and herbicide sprays. And another huge motivator for this work, obviously, is the insects that are on these landscapes. And I just think that rangelands are such a beautiful intermixing of production and conservation. And I just really hope ranchers realize the treasure that they have on their property and just what amazingly complex and diverse things are happening out there, with your flowers and your grasses and the wildlife that uses them. There's just so many amazing stories of life out on these properties. So, just to bring it back to that, and also to stop and take a look, because I think once you start noticing the world of invertebrates and insects, it's so easy just to get sucked in and interested, and you'll quickly find out that there's more to know than you could ever know, and some of it is just mind-blowingly amazing. So just emphasizing how incredible these working lands are and what they bring, to both the ranchers and people that are visiting them, but broadly across our society, they're providing so many resources for humanity. So they're just so valuable.
Yeah, I would add, Ray really hit it on the nose there, but a lot of people, when they think of a grassland or a prairie, they just think of vast areas of grass. And sometimes we forget about the complexities. Our rangelands are home to literally thousands of species of grasses, forbs, shrubs, wildlife, insects, livestock. Like, there's just so much more out there. And we don't understand a lot of the ecosystem services that our rangelands provide to people that aren't even a part of production. So yeah, the core value behind this work stems from a need to protect and improve our native prairie habitats. So I also just want to say that this data, for at least on the SDSU side, is just still rolling in. It can be really overwhelming to just look at all these numbers that we're talking about. So I would just say also stay on the lookout for extension publications from us. And I know that Xerces and NRCS will be publishing stuff as well. So just keep an eye out for that stuff.
Yeah, and I think I'd also volunteer myself and Kaylee. if you've got questions or you're interested, I feel like I'm always open and willing to have a conversation about this data or rangelands and pollinators in general. So Don't be scared to reach out.
Yep, absolutely.
I will be sure to include the contact information for both Kaylee and Ray for those of you who may have questions for them moving forward. And as their publications with their data comes out, you guys will be able to get in contact with them. And I am for sure, or I am for certain, that you guys would have a very engaging conversation with those people. But I want to thank both Kaylee and Ray for joining me on this podcast. I've had such a fun time learning more about rangelands and the plants that call them home. I hope our listeners will take advantage of the information that you have both shared, not only with us, but kind of all over through your jobs, not only on this podcast. And I hope that they take that information home to their operations, but also in their personal lives as well. With that, this has been Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef cattle. Visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information. Until next episode, stay curious and keep learning.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. We invite you to visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, as well as subscribe to the show on Spotify. You will also find show notes and resources from today's episode. Until next time, remember, success is not a goal, it's a byproduct.